Hello and welcome to the Majlis, the podcast by Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, focusing on Central Asia. I'm Mohammed Tahir, your host here in Washington, D.C. It's been 1 year since the unprecedented nationwide protest took place in Kazakhstan. That was in response to Kazakh authorities' efforts to make a reform in land ownership, which, if adopted, would allow foreigners to lease land for an extended period. Authorities thought it will bring badly needed hard currency, but people thought this eventually will lead to a marginalization of Kazakhs. At the end, the confrontation led the authorities to bow down in favor of the public demand. This was an unprecedented development in an unlikely geography. 1 year on since then, what happened to those protests and protesters, to those issues? And more importantly, what changes did this development bring to the country at large and the system? On today's Majlis, we aim to look back and discuss the legacy of that unprecedented action. To discuss the subject, I'm joined by, from Washington, Reid Standish, a journalist who covers Central Asia for the Foreign Policy. From Prague, Bruce Panier, who is the editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Central Asia blog called Kishlak Awazi. From Kazakhstan, we are joined by Aygerim Tolikanova, the Kazakhstan reporter for the Convoy Bulletin. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Majlis.
Thank you.
Very nice to have you. With this, Aygerim, let's start with you. How the first anniversary of those protests remembered in Kazakhstan? For some reason, I remember April 24th to be one of the main dates in that mass upheaval. Was there any activity to mark those events?
As far as I know, there wasn't much activity because basically from this year, I think that people become a bit quiet. They know that they can be arrested for saying something critical, even on social media. And this a year ago, like on April 24th, nobody expected that there will gather such a big crowd in Western Kazakhstan, in Atrau. And it was a shock both for authorities and the people, like not in Western Kazakhstan, but in other parts of Kazakhstan. And nobody expected that finally people can gather over something common.
Interesting. No major activity to mark the day. But Bruce, maybe you want to jump in here. But then it was interpreted as a grassroots movement. How to read the silence after 1 year?
Well, as Aygerim pointed out, the authorities have been pretty clear, you know, going back to right after the May 21st repeat protest, that they weren't going to stand for people to come out and hold unsanctioned rallies. They implemented a number of measures to crack down on people using social networks to spread the message of protests. There are trials still going on of some of those people, and some of those people have been, many people were detained, some of them were jailed for their part in it. They've charged them under criminal laws, which really would be better applied to terrorism or acts of, you know, subversion to overthrow the government or something. But these bloggers and people on social networks have fallen under that Article 174, you know, for inciting hatred of various kinds or something like that. So, you know, that's certainly given anyone who was planning on protest reason to consider very well what the consequences of that could mean. On the other hand, we also, or at least another facet of this, is we have to remember that last year when the protests did start, Kazakhstan was going through severe economic upheavals that were caused by the devaluation of the national currency, the tenge. Since then, in the year since April 24th last year, the tenge has stabilized and somewhat strengthened, largely due to oil going the same route, as having stabilized and actually increased somewhat in value. So there's less anxiety, I think, on the part of the people. The land issue was one of the sparks for the protest, but there were many, many other issues that were dumped into this too. And most of them had to do with the economic situation in Kazakhstan.
I will come back on this to Aygerim, to you, but first, Reid. So, from your point of view, did this mass protest lead to any meaningful development or any change in general in Kazakhstan?
I mean, I don't know how much we can call it meaningful change, but I would say it's very interesting to me because, I mean, as we sort of touched on, right, these protests, I mean, they were about land issues, but I mean, they became this catch-all for a lot of other you know, anxieties and sort of frustrations that people have with the government and the country. And I think for, you know, for the Kazakh government and for a lot of officials, I think that this, the way that this went down, and it was a big wake-up call for them and very surprising. You know, if you remember when this was going on, there was, you know, the government tried to use state media a lot to communicate with its own people, and to see how, you know, ineffective that was, I think was quite surprising for a lot of officials. I think also this sort of revealed some interesting fault lines within the country that maybe were not fully apparent to everyone. You know, the strand of this kind of... what do you want to call it, like economic populism or sort of nativism that, you know, even Kazakhstan is not immune to. You know, a big part of the fear over this land issue is because this, the idea that this land would go to, it would be rented out to the Chinese government or to Chinese settlers, and that Kazakhs would be the ones who are to lose at this. And it kind of exposed a vein of anti-Chinese sentiment in the country, which I think was also something that is a little alarming for the government moving forward as it creates stronger ties with Beijing. But yeah, you know, I think that the government, I think they didn't realize what kind of problems they really had, especially with the kind of, you know, disdain towards issues of corruption. You know, daily life for a lot of people is still broken roads and, you know, corruption at the grassroots. So I think we've seen, you know, there were some levels in dealing with this. They put a moratorium on the ban of land sale to foreigners, but, you know, people haven't really listened to that. I think that they don't really take the government at their word. And we have seen, you know, the devolution of powers that happened later under the constitutional amendments that happened this spring. But, you know, we're still not really seeing a lot here.
You said, Reid, interestingly, that this was a wake-up call for Kazakh authorities. Mm-hmm. Now, since now that they know the nature of the problem that people are facing with, so did they do anything about that?
I mean, do anything. I mean, they put the moratorium on land, which
yeah,
I think
that,
is something.
That's one thing.
You know, I think... I would see, you know, the what we saw this spring in terms of the constitutional amendments, which I think were, or a large part, were cosmetic. But I do see those connected to this in a way. I mean, they, I think there are partly influenced by, you know, the death of Karimov in Uzbekistan, which highlighted to a lot of people, especially in the government, of, you know, the risks of succession in the country. But I don't think it's a coincidence that, you know, they tried to enact some of these changes that, you know, the idea that people will have more of a voice in government, whether they actually do or not, is another question. But at least there has been some movement on this. You know, I don't know if you remember, they did try to enact these, I don't know what you would call them, these pseudo kind of councils, where they were trying to get public input into different reforms and things like that to kind of show that people did have at least some kind of say in their government. And, you know, I wouldn't say that they're really democratic kind of changes. But I think there has been some movement, or at least trying to create the appearance of movement that, you know, there's not a reason. People don't need to go out into the streets to express their frustrations anymore. That's the message that they're trying to send.
Interesting. I agree, as Reid said, as it was reported then when the protests were taking place, or the follow-up of that, the mass upheaval started. Okay, with a single agenda, that was a protest against the land reform, but it quickly, you know, it turned into a platform where people would express anger on many larger issues. Let's recall, what were some of those issues concretely? Then we will discuss that.
I would say people discussed corruption and probably dead political environment, fake elections, and all of this stuff that's before they didn't pay attention to, or they didn't discuss. But with this land movement, people became more open and more willing to discuss this with other fellows. But as we all saw, the government started to detain those who were protesting in the streets, for example, or on social media. And now it's getting to the point where, again, silence and etc.
Mm-hmm. Bruce, what you can add in this context, like land reform was an issue which brought people to the streets, but again, people were also talking about lots of many other issues that, in which you alluded to earlier. Can you recall some of those issues concretely? What were they other than this land reform thing?
Well, there was a problem with housing, for instance. You know, many people had, you know, this is more connected to the devaluation of the tenge, but it certainly raised the level of tension, anxiety that, you know, in the lead up to these protests, a lot of people had taken out loans from banks, and they'd taken out, you know, fairly large sums that were based on the dollar. And so all of a sudden the houses or other expensive property they bought, vehicles, things like that, they weren't able to pay it back. And the government didn't have a plan to try to bail them out. And so there was a lot of problems with people. You know, they were losing their houses. They were losing things that they'd counted on, because Kazakhstan was developing something of a middle class. People had become accustomed to life generally getting better and themselves generally becoming a little bit richer, you know, not rich, but certainly a little bit better off financially. And all of a sudden that got pulled out from under their feet. And so there was a lot of problems around that. Prior to the big protests in April and May, there were much smaller ones, you know, already in late January last year, in February, you know, and things like that, that were focused on housing and people losing their homes and trying to get the government to come up with some plan so that they could maintain their home and still make payments at some different rate or on a different schedule than they had been previously. So I think that was really one of the main issues that kind of fed into that. And, you know, it was kind of kept under control more or less, but it was sparked. That came to the fore once the spark of the land privatization issue was lit. And so that was one, I would say, one of the primary things that jumped into the protests very, very quickly after they started.
Mm-hmm. Those demands, except the land reform, generally ignored, as you guys are talking about. So what happened to people's anger? Yes, authorities repressed them, arrested many people, but people knew that they will be arrested. But what about the anger? It went away?
Is this for me?
Yeah.
And yeah, you know, I don't think that it entirely went away. But again, I would get back to the point that, you know, things when the protests started out, things had gotten bad and they were getting gradually worse. And that is no longer the case. Things are not great in Kazakhstan, but the economic situation has stabilized. And there, you know, again, as I mentioned, there's been some slight improvement, which kind of, I think, rekindled people's hopes that possibly they're going to go back to the, you know, the heady days of 5 or 6 years ago, where, you know, money didn't really seem to be a huge issue and things would probably get better. So there's less reason at the moment. You know, people have kind of adapted to the new economic reality. It's not getting worse, and it is kind of slowly getting a little bit better. So that's one of the big changes right now. You know, and again, just the fact that everyone saw the authorities' response to the Kazakh government authorities' credit, they did not resort to strong arm tactics. I mean, they really tried during these protests to not get involved with clashes with the protesters, remembering what happened in Zhanaozen, you know, in 2011. They didn't want a repeat of that. So, you know, while there were mass detentions, there weren't reports of clashes between police and protesters. And I think that also helped them this year that, you know, there wasn't that nasty violence, you know, that was to be associated with last year's protests. So there wasn't quite as much reason for people to be angry this year over what had happened last year, except for obviously the people that were detained, the ones that were jailed, the ones that are still being held or on trial. You know, clearly them and their families are still in a bad situation. But overall, I would say I think most people would agree that the economic situation and the social situation in Kazakhstan today is much better than it was 1 year ago today.
Then, Aygrim, let me bring you here. So since the mass protests last year, a number of decisions were taken by the authorities, by President Nazarbayev, such as changes in the top leadership, reorganization of some offices, some promotions, including his own daughter. Did they had any link to the protests?
I think that these changes in top management is not maybe that related to the protests, but I think that the changes in law, like the constitution changes, now deputies of parliament are passing the bill that could deprive of citizenship for example, for calling to change political system, for example, or for terrorism issues. And also our media law is changing. It's becoming more restrictive for journalists. And after this protest, there was a creation of new Ministry of Information and Communication, which is also, I think, a response of the government to the people so that maybe to show that they're trying to communicate with its own people, but still this ministry is the one that takes initiative to change media law that is becoming more restrictive to journalists. And all these changes in laws will impact our society because they are becoming more restrictive, as I said, and they give more power, for example, to security services and other authorities to go into private lives of citizens. And I think that was the reason why they changed laws after protests. But with the top management, I think it's more related to maybe succession of power.
Reid, anything you want to add in this?
Yeah, I think Igram is right to sort of touch on the changes around the media environment. Mm. I know in my own conversations with various people on this issue, I mean, I think that that was a big thing, especially for the government, of how the troubles that they really had in communicating with their own people and trying to get them, you know, hey, go home, don't come out and protest, there are other ways to deal with this. You know, that was a really much a message that was put out on state media, and it really didn't resonate at all with anyone. And I think that they're really been trying to reevaluate how to do that. Generally the impulse is, as Igram raised, is to try and constrain things more and, you know, limit independent voices further. But I think that that is really important. You know, if we look at, you know, what were the changes that sparked this, right? I mean, the changes were basically on the surface, if you look at what they were, they're not that objectionable, right? It was they're going to make land, you know, at an auction, which actually could create some level of transparency about who is actually buying land. And then the idea was that it was going to make it incentivize investment and try to bring in some more money into the agriculture mm-hmm. sector, which, I mean, on the surface, there's nothing wrong with doing that. But it's just that no one trusted that what the government was actually saying to it was its real motives. Mm-hmm. And I think that that is really at the heart of where all of this is that there's people don't believe their government, what they're saying to it.
Mm. I will come back, Bruce, to you. But first, on the other thing, I agree. If there was one thing clear about protesters' demand, that was like people's anti-Chinese sentiment. Like when the authorities would discuss about the possibility of leasing land to foreigners, people would talk about Chinese coming in masses and not leaving back. So how did this anti-Chinese feeling translated in government policies or people's reactions against them over the past year?
Well, now I think anti-Chinese rhetoric has come down, but the government, I would say, usually prefers to keep silence when something like this happens. For example, when there were protests in Astana regarding the dating agency that would allow Chinese men to come and see Kazakh women, I would say that government was probably embarrassed to comment on such issue because it's a diplomatic issue already. And many Chinese officials gave comments to Kazakh media that their intentions are not to invade Kazakhstan and they want to live peacefully and etc. So, yeah, in these terms, they are trying to not to be neutral, I would say. And what was your other question?
That was the question, basically. Like there was a, you know, voices were raised against, you know, Chinese people coming to Kazakhstan, grabbing land, and they are not going back. So, I mean, did this sentiment, like public sentiment, influence the authorities' decision in any way?
I think that this anti-Chinese movement was also sparked first in social media because there were lots of fake stories, for example, how Chinese even like make fake foods and sell them to other nations or take lands in other countries and turn them into like non-fertile soil and etc. So in social media, people were really like reading this and watching and going to streets because of that. And there is, I would say, maybe deep fear inside, maybe every Kazakh, I don't know. But since childhood, as far as I remember, we would always be taught that Kazakhstan is between Russia and China, and they are two big empires, and we have to somehow be be good friends with boss. And it's better to be friends with Russia, for example, than with China, because there is less freedom with Chinese, under Chinese authority, I would say. At least that's what were talks at school during my time. And I'm sure that many people had these conversations too.
Interesting. Now, when the protesters were out in the street, it was a huge deal. But as I understand, it did not really lead to any major development. Why was that? Also, why couldn't anyone tap into those anger? What did the authorities do to prevent this move from turning to a major opposition? And what is the takeaway from all this? We will continue the debate shortly, discussing this and many other questions. Hey everyone, before we get into the second part of the show, just a quick reminder that if you really like the Majlis podcast, there's a real chance that you will also like my other radio show that's called Gandhara Podcast. The show discusses latest developments in Pakistan and Afghanistan from local perspective. And the podcast is published in every second week on Radio Free Europe Radio Liberty's Gandhara website. It's a totally must-follow discussion for foreign policy nerds with interest in the region. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. So first, let me recap the debate that today we are discussing the implications or lack of that following the last year's mass land reform protest in Kazakhstan. I'm joined by Reid Standish, foreign policy journalist focusing on Central Asia, Bruce Panier, editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty Central Asia blog called Kishlak Awazi, and Aygerim Tulipanova, the Kazakhstan correspondent for the Convoy Bulletin. I'm Mohammed Tahir, host of the Majlis here in Washington, D.C. Bruce, first question to you. So one year is on, no massive desire to remember those events. Also, the events did not lead to any major change. Expectations of people are generally ignored, except the land reform project was suspended. But the larger issues, as you said, remains as it is. So when you sit back and look into those events of the last year today, what do you understand? What was all those mobilization about?
Well, I mean, obviously, there was a number of problems there that people just hadn't voiced, you know, a lot of concerns, fears, you know, and this was a chance for them to let everything out, you know, in one pretty much in just a very short space of time. Since then, I would say one of the reasons, if we're talking about why we haven't seen any of this, there's a couple of reasons why we haven't seen this continue since then. One is that the opposition was neutralized years ago. So it was hard to find a leader or a group that could have harnessed this and carried it forward. But the protests themselves, of course, that was probably the biggest protest. Certainly the one in May was probably the biggest protest that has ever happened in Kazakhstan in its 25 years of independence. That spooked the authorities, and rightfully so. And they have made more of an effort to at least publicly talk about some of these issues and make guarantees to people that they are working on these kind of problems and various issues. So they've really gone out of their way. I don't see evidence of a lot of progress on the ground, but they have stepped up efforts to try to communicate a message to people that we are aware of your concerns and we are trying to do something about it. And you know, which means there is no need to protest at all anymore, because we hear you. And we're trying to do something about it, you know. And at the same time, too, they've offered up some of them. I suppose you'd have to call them political sacrifices. I mean, some of these people who clearly were corrupt, and I'm talking about the former economics minister Bishambaev, for instance. I mean, there's been people like that were arrested and then charged with, you know, for incredible financial crimes and stuff. And that also helps, you know, with the people too, where they see that some of the big guys at the top are actually, you know, being taken down for stealing money from the people. So that calms things down a little bit too. So there's, it's not that the problems have gone away. I would say most of them are probably just about as bad as they were. But at least the government is offering public assurances that they will deal with these issues. And they do hear the people and they're trying to make things better. And like I said, to some extent, some of this stuff has gotten a little bit better. Maybe not so much because of the Kazakh government's efforts as the bulk of revenues for Kazakhstan's budget come from oil sales. And since the price of oil has gone up a little bit from what it was a year ago, with no signs that it's going to have such a precipitous fall like it did. I think that there's the comfort zone among the people is expanding a little bit in Kazakhstan now.
Would you agree with Bruce, what he just said, that people are a little bit calmed down? There were some promises, which was helpful.
Yeah, I agree with Bruce. Now people are more or less calm, and the government indeed did try to listen to people's voices. For example, they created Land Commission, although most of the people were there not from opposition side, but still there were some critical voices in this Land Commission that were very close to people, ordinary people, and they would gather the voices of ordinary people and tell it to the higher ministries and make their voices heard. But in the end, even though this Land Commission was working for a few months, the government still decided just to freeze this law without any details that were that the Land Commission was working on in this land reform. And now I think that people are maybe they're waiting for something to happen, because now we're on the eve of transition of power, and now people come down and they just, I don't know, maybe they wait what happens next, because they know that if they will try to create opposition or to voice some concern or be critical, they will be silenced or detained for sure, because government is showing its power through the policemen or detentions. And I think that's just calm down before the storm.
Interesting. So all these efforts by the people was not really fruitless. So authorities did make some changes in the way they operate, at least that they decided to listen to concerns of people, made some promises. So what is the main takeaway in general from the events of last year?
My main takeaway of this is, there really is no political opposition per se left in Kazakhstan. It's been effectively kneecapped over the years. People have been arrested, pushed out of politics, driven into exile. Media is pretty much state controlled. But I think the takeaway of this is, even though there is no real opposition, as you would see in a lot of other countries, there isn't really political opposition, but there is still dissent, and people will still come and they won't be shy about voicing it. That's not going to be so much centered itself on these political issues. These weren't protests for more democratic rights per se, or at least on the surface. If you roll them back and peel them back a bit more, you could say, people wanted more of a voice. They wanted more representation in these things. So I think it's interesting, to see that even, 25 years of post-Soviet independence, that, this sort of this push for a voice from the people is not gone, even in a country that's, authoritarian like Kazakhstan.
Unfortunately, we also conclude our discussion. Bruce, is there anything we haven't discussed yet?
The only thing I would add is that is that although things are calm and stuff, we've hit all around this during the discussion, but there is a power in the Kazakh people. And I think that the government hadn't seen that before, and it was something that they won't forget in the very near future. So any changes that the Kazakh government made, they're going to try to figure in what the popular reaction is going to be a lot more closely than they had previously, where they a lot of times I don't think they really paid a whole lot of attention and sometimes maybe even ignored what the people might say about this. But that's no longer possible. I think that was one of the lessons the authorities learned, was that they really do have to take the people's opinion into consideration, or at least how they will react to certain moves and changes within the government structure, the way the society is governed, that kind of stuff.
Okay, last point, Aygrim. If the land reform thing comes to the agenda tomorrow, how you anticipate the reaction by the people?
I think if there won't be leaders like the ones that are jailed now, Max Bokaev and Talgat Ayan, probably people will not pay much attention to these land reforms. But it depends. As I mentioned, nobody expected that these land reforms would gather so many people that would be so concerned with the fate of their land and the future of land in Kazakhstan. So you never know which law would, spark this protest mood. And with land reforms, if they will stay the same as they are now, I'm sure like many people who were very concerned with the land issue would come out to the streets again and voice their concerns. But if the government will change the law, like people want it, then I think everything will be okay.
Bruce, the proposal, it is just temporarily suspended. Discussion yet to take place on that, right?
Yeah, I mean, they basically just kicked the can down the road. Mm-hmm. Now, Nazarbayev put a moratorium on it until after his current term ends. So it's not really coming up, or at least it can't come into effect until after 2020. I think they even said it might be like 2022 or something before they try to enact it. But they basically just postponed the whole thing in the hopes that they could just push this issue aside. They're really going to have to come to terms with what kind of foreign ownership or leasing or whatever that they're going to have to implement. I mean, there's two sides to this. The people in Kazakhstan, one, they don't want to see foreigners come in and claim all this land, even though, as Reed suggested, there's very good reasons why it makes sense to let someone at least lease the land and use agricultural land to grow something instead of just leaving it there empty. It would help Kazakhstan. It would help a lot and help a lot of people, actually, if they could export this extra grain, fruit, whatever they probably grain. On the other hand, the people don't want to see the rich people in Kazakhstan buy up all the land either. So the government's going to have to figure that out, too. The people are very aware of the relatively small group of people who have a lot of money in Kazakhstan and are the only ones who are really in any financial position to actually buy this land up or even lease it. And that would also aggravate the situation, too, if they see that the same people who have been getting rich for years and years are the only ones that can access this land that's all of a sudden up for sale. So the government, they gave themselves a few years to consider how they're going to rework this legislation or these ideas so that they can give it more popular appeal and at the same time take out some of the worries and concerns, legitimate worries and concerns that people have about who will be the ones to actually acquire this land, whether long-term or for on a rental basis.
Okay, thank you very much. Bruce Panier, the editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Central Asia blog called Kishlag Awazi. Reed Standish. Reed, you are heading to Kazakhstan soon. Thank you very much for today.
Thanks
that you were able to join us.
And also, thank you.
Also, thank you, Aygrim Tolikanova, Kazakhstan correspondent for the Convoy Bulletin, for the insightful comments today.
Thank you.
Thank you. And this is it from me, Mohammed Tahir, host of the Majlis, here in Washington, D.C. Until next week, bye-bye.